Good morning and welcome to Faithfully Memphis. I am Father Jesse Abel, and I am the priest in charge of All Saints Episcopal Church at the corner of Quince and White Station Road. All Saints is one of the 38 or so congregations of the Episcopal Diocese of West Tennessee, and I'm happy to be here with you this morning since Bishop Phoebe is not able to be here. Faithfully Memphis broadcast from WYXR 91.7 FM in Memphis, Tennessee. This show is an opportunity to talk about real people and their real stories of faith in the world today. And this morning, I'm joined in the studio by my dear friend, the incomparable Dr. Deborah Harmon Hines, who insists that I call her Debbie, so you'll be hearing me call her that. And I'm going to tell you a bit about her in a little bit, and she's going to be our guest today and sharing some of her story. But first, it's our custom at Faithfully Memphis to talk in the first segment about saints. Now, often we think of saints as those big legendary names from Christian history, St. Paul, St. Francis, St. Patrick. Christian theologians remind us, however, that there are millions of saints whose names we might never know, because anyone can be a saint if they simply follow Jesus. A saint is a person of faith who has experienced Christ, and we remember and we celebrate saints because they inspire us to remain faithful in our own lives. And while there are great stories of saints from history, sometimes we can find them much closer to home, literally. Debbie and I were talking about an influential saint in her own life whose big day happens to come at the end of January and who shares a name with me. Debbie, would you tell us more about him?
Reverend Dr. Jesse Abel, thank you for inviting me to be with you this morning. And the saint I would like to share with you is Jesse James Harmon, my dad, who was born January 29th, 1918. My father died in 1994, but he did so much to shape my life and my faith. And I offered to share that with you.
Oh, terrific. Yeah.
When I was growing up, there was a movie called Green Pastures. It was an all-black movie made in the late 1930s or the early 1940s in black and white. So if the viewers want to see it, look it up. Rochester was in it, Ethel Waters, and this was in the day when she was a glamour queen. Were in the movie, and there was a character who played God, and that character looked like my dad. So I grew up thinking God was black. Now, most people see all the pictures of God and Jesus, and they see some blonde, blue-eyed dude, but the God I knew looked just like my daddy. And my family attended church together. Not far from where I live now, Castilia Missionary Baptist Church. We looked forward to going to church every Sunday together. My dad sang in the men's group, and they sang every fifth Sunday. So we thoroughly enjoyed hearing the men's voices rolling and singing. And God and my dad were just there every day. I shared this story with you that when you're little and they teach you how to do housekeeping, you tend not to clean under the beds. But we were told we had to clean up under the bed to get the dust bunnies out because God could see under the bed and see the dust bunnies. So God was everywhere. God was a part of everything. And my introduction to God and religion was through my mother and my father. So the saint I'm sharing with you today is Jesse James Harmon, and his saint's day is January 29th.
Oh, terrific. And you said that growing up, he instilled in you some values about how you approach the world, right?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Now, I grew up under strict segregation. And one thing, my father never met a stranger. My father could hold a conversation with anybody, anywhere, anytime. The president of the United States, he could have a conversation with him. So my father taught us how to greet people. The other thing is our parents taught us you are not better than anybody else, but nobody else is better than you. Mm-hmm. So this whole thing about segregation, I didn't believe. I just, as they say, I thought it was a hoax.
Wow.
It was a hoax. And even though I lived under segregation right here in Memphis, we could only go to the zoo one day a week. We could only go to the amusement park one day a week. We could only go to the state park one day a week. Even though our taxes paid for these things 7 days a week, we couldn't go swimming except for one day a week. And the day after the black kids went into the swimming pools were drained so that the pools could be disinfected and the white kids wouldn't catch diseases from us. But in spite of all of that, I grew up thinking nobody was better than me. And I was not better than anybody else. And to always treat people with respect and with kindness. So these things have lived with me my entire life.
And I was going to say, like, if I someone had to ask me, how would you describe Deborah Harmon Hines? I would say that Debbie has an immense joy that you see right away. I mean, I'm sure people, although they're listening to you, can see your smile as you talk. That must be a bit of a tribute to your father and mother.
Oh, my dad had a smile that a million watt smile, and it just pulled you in. It just pulled you in, and part of the joy of when my dad would walk home from Memphis Furniture Factory along the railroad tracks. And the people use the railroad tracks like they use streets. We could see my dad down the street smiling. And as soon as he turned the corner and we saw his smile, we went running down the street to greet him and hang on him. And even though this man had worked all day in a factory, we had no idea what that meant, but my dad's smile just pulled us in. And so, yeah, I think I got that from him. Now, the people listening can't see that I have a gap a mile wide between my front two teeth. And in spite of wearing braces, I told them to leave that alone because that's a part of me. And my dad had a gap. My dad had a gap like that. So, we learned to be who we were. We learned to be authentic. And we learned to meet everybody on the same level, regardless of title, regardless of race, regardless of gender. We were just taught that. It was ingrained in us.
Oh, your father sounds like an amazing man.
Oh, he was. He was. And he only had about a fifth grade education as far as we are able to ascertain.
Wow. He reminds me of even a lot of the stories, has a lot of the tributes that some of the classic saints in church history have, especially that joy in the face of adversity and challenge.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. After my father died and we were going through his things, we found little books. They were about 3 inches tall, 2 inches wide. And in those books were his prayer lists. There were dates on them, and there were people's names, and these were people he was praying for. So as a part of his regular prayer life, he prayed for people, and here was the evidence of that.
Wow.
Our father also taught us how to deal with money. When I was growing up, black people couldn't put money in white banks. So my dad came home and emptied his pockets of change. And we had penny banks, nickel banks, dime banks, quarter banks. There was even something called a bow dollar, a silver dollar, and dollar banks.
Wow.
And when we got ready to go to college, we rolled up the coins. And that's how my dad paid for my sister and I to go to college, with the change out of his pocket, because we could not use the banks.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for sharing your father's story. Truly, sometimes we don't have to look very far to find someone who really represents God being present with us and to inspire us to continue down that road of faith.
Absolutely.
Stay tuned, and we'll be back with Faithfully Memphis. Welcome back. In our next half, I'd like to turn the conversation more towards you, Debbie, and a reminder to all of our guests out there that we're speaking with Dr. Deborah Harmon Hines this morning about her experience of faith. Before I let you get started, though, let me introduce her a little more. Debbie is a Memphis native, having grown up in the Castilla neighborhood of the city, and she is a graduate of Hamilton High School. She went on to study biology at Lemoyne Owen College and then earned her PhD in anatomy from the University of Tennessee Health Science Center. When I met Debbie in central Massachusetts, she had a distinguished career at the University of Massachusetts Medical School, where most recently she served as Vice Provost for Student Services, Professor of Cell Biology and Nursing, and Professor of Radiology. After retiring, UMass named her Professor Emeritus of Radiology. Now, that's the professional side of things. I also know her more personally from her active lay ministry work in the Episcopal Church in Western Massachusetts. She also has been active on the national stage in the Episcopal Church. She is a past president of the Union of Black Episcopalians and is one of the framers of the Episcopal Church's Lift Every Voice and Sing hymnal. It's an Afro-American hymnal in our church. She has actively worked at the General Convention, the National Gathering of the Episcopal Church, and has worked internationally with the church in Liberia pretty extensively. On top of all that, she is married to the Reverend John Edgar Freeman, who is a colleague of mine, and both of them have graced my previous congregation by preaching and sharing their stories there. Debbie, although I introduced you sort of through these two domains of life, your professional career and your ministry in the church, you would be the first to say that they're not really separate from each other. Is that correct?
That is correct, Jesse. I don't compartmentalize my life. It's all one big gamoosh. And let me go back to when I discovered God. Mm-hmm. You're not old enough to remember this, but for my generation, we would have bomb drills when we would go out into the hallway or get under our desk to prepare for a nuclear bomb to be dropped.
Wow.
We do this at least once a week. And I went to the library. Now, I had to go to the Black library and ask for an interlibrary loan from the white library to get a book on nuclear physics so that I could figure out what this atom bomb thing was. And I was in the third grade, and I discovered that the smallest, simplest unit was the hydrogen atom, one proton, one neutron, one electron. And if you took a second hydrogen atom and hurled it at the first and they collided, that would cause an explosion that could wipe out a whole city. And I said, there must be a God, because humans couldn't have figured that out.
Wow.
We're not that smart. We're not that good. And right then and there, God was there. God was, and from there, you learn that the next thing was helium. Mm-hmm. And for the chemist and the audience, I'm going on the periodic chart. And you kept adding hydrogen. You kept adding parts of the hydrogen, the proton, the neutron, electron, until you got all of the chemical elements. And I thought that was just brilliant. And we weren't smart enough to make this up. It was already there. We discovered it. We decoded it as humans. And I figured God then was everywhere. And who was I then to try to compartmentalize God and put a little God over here, a little God over there? It was all around me. It totally surrounded me. Now, that was my first step towards being a scientist. The second step was when I saw a water pipe coming out of the wall. That pipe divided into two pipes, and one went to a fountain that said white, and the other went to a fountain that said colored. And I'm thinking, but there's just one source of water. What's the difference? And when nobody was looking, I conducted my own scientific experiment and took a drink out of the white water fountain and discovered it was the same water.
Wow.
And from that, I realized I had to think for myself. I couldn't believe any and everything that somebody else told me. And that this whole thing about separate water fountains, separate but equal, was a creation of human beings to keep us apart, not to bring us together. So in my mind, I totally dismissed that. And it was because of my belief in God that God created water, just water, for all of us to drink. And if all of us drank from the same water, we were all equal. We were all human, and we might all even be related. So I couldn't separate my belief system from anything else in my life. It was all a part of the same bowl, so to speak. And within my work at the university, everybody knew that I was a church lady. And people should know the University of Massachusetts Medical School was about 95% white when I was there. But everybody knew that Deborah Harmon Hines was a church lady. And often students would come to me before an exam and say, Dr. Hines, would you pray for me before this exam?
Oh, really?
And especially before their step exams. These were the exams to get their licenses to practice medicine.
Wow.
I was often on honor code committee hearings because people understood my philosophy on honor. You know, that we treat every human being with dignity. You don't lie, you don't steal, you don't kill. And so everybody at the medical school understood exactly where I came from. And I think the institution saw that as an asset and used me in that way. Now, on the church side of my life, everybody in the church knew that I taught human anatomy and that I knew where all the parts were in the body, and often came to me to help me to help them understand medical issues, the background on medical issues. As a matter of fact, recently for the Union of Black Episcopalians, I did a piece on why African Americans and other minorities should get the COVID vaccine, because there's a great distrust for that in our community. And I began by explaining the science behind the vaccine. So, no, the two parts of my life always came together. It was just all one big part.
Now, we often hear sort of just as common wisdom that science and faith are somehow sort of opposed or working at cross purposes. But you have a very different experience.
And many of my colleagues feel exactly the way that I feel. Many of my colleagues in the world of science and medicine are deep believers. Some are Christians, some are Muslims, some are Buddhist, but they all believe in a supreme being. And that supreme being responsible for the creation of the world as we know it and of the universe as we know it. So the people that I know and associate with in science and medicine feel like I do.
Now, in your work teaching anatomy, did you find affirmations of this great creator in your work?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, if you don't mind me sharing this story, my friend Jesse was taking anatomy this semester, and he called me up to help him to understand the anatomy of the heart. And we were talking about the valves of the heart. There's a particular valve called the mitral valve, and it's because it looks like the bishop's mitre.
The hat, yeah.
It looks like the bishop's hat with the two points on it. And I said, Jesse, the mitral valve is always on the left because, as we know, laugh, the bishop is never right.
And we don't need to tell Bishop Phoebe about that.
but I'm saying that's how much it became a part of my work in understanding how the body worked, the body is a beautiful machine. God created that machine. Everything in the body has a counterpart in architecture. As we talked about valves opening, doors only open one way. A valve is a type of door that only opens in one direction. And hinges, you have hinge joints, just like the hinges on the door. And for me, as I said, God created all of that. The machine, the great machines of the world are also inside our bodies. So to me, the body is just a beautiful machine that God created.
And you sort of see evidence of his ingenuity absolutely. In the parts.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I don't understand how people desecrate the body. It's so beautiful. It's so beautiful. And God gave it to us. That's where we live, inside our bodies. And I don't think we do a very good job of taking care of our bodies.
A lot of truth there. Now, you've spent much of your adult life in the Episcopal Church, and I wonder if I could ask you a little about that experience. I often think the Episcopal Church at least has a reputation for being rather WASPy. I mean that by being white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant. And certainly that must have been an interesting experience growing up as a young Black girl, finding the Episcopal Church and joining a church with such a heritage.
Okay. So here's the backstory on that. When I became a teenager, we always attended church together as a family. We attended a Baptist church. And they gave me this list of things I couldn't do. We couldn't dance. We couldn't play cards. We couldn't go to movies on Sundays. And being the rational person that I was, I asked my parents, why is this? I don't understand the correlation between dancing and being a Christian. And my parents agreed. They said, well, we don't particularly agree with that either. I said, well, I'm going to go find a church that can answer some of these questions for me, because they wouldn't answer the questions about why we couldn't do those things. And I began my vision quest or my belief quest. Mm-hmm. And I attended a lot of different denominations. I had a list of things that I was looking for, a list of questions that I wanted answered. I even looked at becoming a Muslim. I looked at the Catholic Church. I looked at the Methodist Church, the Presbyterian. All of those things were present here in Memphis at the time. And when I got to the Episcopal Church and asked the questions, when it came to the point that they couldn't answer the questions, they simply said, well, we just don't know.
Sure.
And I like that. I like the fact that they could admit they didn't know the answers. And that left room for me to explore what those answers might be. And as a result of that, then, I joined the Episcopal Church, Emmanuel Episcopal Church.
Oh, of course.
And I would have to get up on Sunday morning and ride the bus to get to church for an hour. The people at the church were so kind, they would often bring me home in the evenings. But I joined the choir. They would have Friday night canteen where we would have evening prayer, and then we would dance. I said, this has got to be, I've hit a gold mine here. I can have it all. And so I became active in the Episcopal Church in Memphis as a young person. At Emmanuel, we had a very sizable youth group, that is, of young people who were high school age, who would come together and serve as acolytes. Back in those days, they wouldn't let girls serve as acolytes. So I refused to be on the altar guild. I refused to do anything that was girl only. But I sang in the choir. I participated in the Episcopal youth group in the church and in the diocese. And I also attended the camp sponsored by Emmanuel Church up in Mason, Tennessee.
Okay.
And later, I was sent by Emmanuel Church to the Diocesan Episcopal Camp Center at DuBose, right outside of Chattanooga. I was one of the first Black campers to go to DuBose. And that caused quite a stir.
I can imagine.
Because at that time, the Episcopal Church in Memphis was segregated. All of the Black people went to Emmanuel, and all of the white people went to all of the other churches. And so you knew your place. Wow. You knew your place. And I could hear people speaking in the background when I would go to the Episcopal youth events on Sunday evenings at a local Episcopal church to say, well, it's a good thing it's a Sunday evening, so people can't see her here.
Oh.
That was the Episcopal church I grew up in. But nevertheless, I was nurtured and I was encouraged from Emmanuel to ask questions, to seek, to discover. And I give Emmanuel Church a lot of credit for my formation as to who I am today.
Wow. And of course, Emmanuel Church is still in operation today.
It still is in operation today. And my good friend, Dr. Reverend Colenso Hubbard, just retired. And I think he must have been there for more than 20 years. But over the years, I continued to consider Emmanuel Church my church home.
Wow. Now, having had that experience of growing up being the minority in the Episcopal Church, with segregation even within the church, do you remember what your reaction was to the election of Michael Curry, a black man, as the presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church?
I remember my reaction to Michael Curry's election, not because he was a black man, but because I knew him personally. I go back with Michael Curry when he was in Cincinnati, Ohio, a young priest in the early 1980s. At that time, I was national president of the Union of Black Episcopalians.
Oh, of course.
And we had some event there. And that was the first time I met Michael Curry. My election as the national president of the Union of Black Episcopalians was unusual in that I was the first woman to ever hold that position and the second layperson.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize
that. And so that caused a big stir. The priest I grew up under, Eddie Manuel, Jared Atkins, called me up to say, Debbie, he said, I heard you got elected national president to UBE, and I don't hold much to women holding leadership positions in the church. I'm sitting there holding the phone listening to this.
Wow.
To someone who I have a great deal of respect. But he kept talking, and he said, and you're like a daughter to me, and you are doing things we would like to see our daughter do. So I guess I'm going to have to change my mind. I guess I'm going to have to support you because you're like my daughter. And he did, right? In that conversation, he talked himself out of his original position. And he single-handedly called many of the senior black clergy in the church and said, you know, Debbie is like a daughter to me, and we are going to have to get behind her and support her. And I got this overwhelming wave of support. Wow. From the senior black clergy of the church that enabled me to do the kinds of things that I did as UBE president. So going back to Michael Curry, I was just so happy that this guy that I knew personally and had followed from Cincinnati to St. James in Baltimore, and then to being elected bishop of North Carolina. I mean, I know him as Michael. I don't know him as the presiding bishop. I felt that it was overdue time. I can remember when John Walker, who was then the bishop of the Diocese of Washington, D.C., and raised enough money to complete the cathedral in the Diocese of Washington, D.C., ran for presiding bishop. He was the first black person to run for presiding bishop. And he did not get elected. After the election was over, he said, Debbie, if everybody who had said they were going to vote for me had voted for me, I would be presiding bishop. Oh. And so for me, for Michael's election, my only thought was, well, it's about time.
And of course, Michael is still as approachable as ever, even as presiding bishop.
Oh, yeah. But he's Michael. He's just Michael. The way I've always known Michael, going back to the 1980s.
Wow. And then some listeners may recognize his name from the royal wedding, having preached at the wedding of Prince Harry and Meghan Markle.
And I've heard people say, well, why does he preach like that? He's always preached like that. We've always known that. It's no secret in the black church that that's the way he preaches. But there are a number of black clergy in the Episcopal Church who preach in that style.
Sure.
Who preach in that style. So that's not unusual for us to hear in the black church. I think Colenso preaches like that.
So the Episcopal Church actually has a lot more depth and diversity than what people might associate with it.
It does, but it doesn't capitalize on it. It does. And as I travel around this church, when I was national president of UBE, I was in a different black Episcopal church every other Sunday for 6 years.
Wow.
All over this country. So I saw all kinds of black Episcopal churches. One of the larger representations is from the Caribbean and the West Indian contingent who came to us from the Anglican tradition.
Okay.
But now what I'm seeing is lots of clergy coming to us from Africa and the Anglican tradition. Now, my husband was in Episcopal Church in Liberia, which the Episcopal Church of Liberia came out of the Episcopal Church of the United States. But he trained in Sierra Leone in the Anglican tradition.
Oh, sure.
So as I travel around now, I'm seeing more black clergy coming out of Africa because I'm told there is a clergy shortage.
That's what they say, yeah.
I'm told. And I see that the African church and the Caribbean church is helping to fill that. Those two churches are helping to fill the void.
Well, if you'll stay tuned, we're going to listen to one of Debbie's favorite songs, Center of My Joy, and then we'll be right back.
When I've lost my direction, you're the compass for my way. You're the fire. When nights are long and cold, in sadness, you are the laughter that shatters all my fears. When I'm all alone, your hand is there to hold.
Sorrow. You are.
And welcome back. In the final segment of Faithfully Memphis, it's customary for the host to answer questions from people about faith and religion. I put out on social media that I was going to be hosting the show today, and some people sent in some questions. And the first one was sent in by someone I know named Bill, who posed this question: what if you pray really hard and you don't get what you want? And I think that's a great question, because all of us, I think, have that experience of faith where there's something that you're really praying for or desiring, and you pray to God and are disappointed and let down. So it's a great question. I thought first of my own little boys. I have a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old, and our 2-year-old has some digestive issues, enough that we had to take him to a gastroenterologist at UMass, not far from where Debbie worked. And one of the things they pinpointed for helping prevent trouble for him was to limit his dairy intake. The doctor said maximum 16 ounces of dairy a day, and that's with yogurt and milk and cheese and everything. And yet this kid loves a dairy. So he will have his milk, he would have some yogurt, and it's not uncommon for him at the end of the day to come and to beg and say, "Daddy, I want yogurt. Daddy, I want yogurt." And he is so sweet, and he's begging. And yet, as the parent, I know sort of in the bigger picture how that affects his health. And so I have to say, no, little buddy, I know you like it, but you could have maybe some fruit, but no yogurt. And I wonder if God, looking from God's perspective, somehow knows sometimes that something that we may think we really need or really want may not be what's best for us in the bigger picture. I had a personal experience of that where shortly after getting married, my wife and I followed her career to take a job offer in a small city. And going into the city, we had the expectation that there would be any number of positions, they said, for church work. And when we got there, there really was only one. And it was a very part-time position at a small church in a little town about 40 miles out of the city. Half the storefronts on Main Street were empty. And yet I wanted it so desperately. But I was one of 3 people that were moving in with their spouses and all looking for jobs. And I prayed so fervently to God, begging God to let me have this job because I needed this job. And there was that sense of desperation that, yeah, this may not be what I had in mind. It may not be ideal, but I have to have it. And I remember the disappointment when I didn't get a call to that church. I would say I was even so angry at God, like, "You let me down. I'm trying to do your work, and this doesn't come through." It was about 6 months later that my wife said, "Why don't you open up your options and look in other parts of the country? And maybe this is a sign that we need to move together." And so I started working through the official channels in the Episcopal Church to find an assignment. But a parish heard about me by word of mouth shortly after that, called me from this town in central Massachusetts. I didn't know where Massachusetts was. I didn't know there was anything north of New York. And yet this layperson who called me had a great conversation with me, invited me to come out, and I met a great committee of people that I clicked with instantly. And I still believe that I was called to be with that group of people, and they were called to find me, and we were perfect for each other at that time. And it's only in hindsight that I realize, had I gotten that very part-time job I so desperately wanted, I wouldn't have been looking for a job, and I wouldn't have been available when the right place came along. So I think sometimes when we pray and we don't get what we want, it may be that God is looking at something better down the road. I truly believe God loves us. I believe prayer makes a difference. And I think sometimes we just have to have a different perspective. Now, Debbie, I'm told that you have your own question for the Stump the Priest segment.
Yes. You just earned your D.Min, I believe, from the University of South at Sewanee, one of the most hallowed institutions in the Episcopal Church. And I just wanted you to share a little bit about the history of that institution and how that institution is trying to redress itself today.
That's a great question. Especially, I think what we're realizing at this moment in American history is that we really have to be honest about our past and to come to terms with the mistakes and even the sins that institutions have created. Suwannee has a complex history. It started just before the Civil War and was founded by a group of Southern bishops in particular, who were really tired of having to have their Southern clergy trained by Northerners by people who would change the Southern way of life, which meant, among other things, the abolition of slavery. James Odie, who still has a church named after him, Odie Memorial Parish there in Suwannee, was in particular quoted as saying that having their own university would aid the South to resist and repel a fanatical domination. And that's how the concept for the University of the South came into being. And in fact, they needed money to get everything off the ground. One of their primary financial backers was the most prominent figure in American slavery. Now, the church and the seminary haven't talked a lot about that history. They're rather focused upon the present and the great thing that the seminary is doing. But especially in the wake of the Black Lives Movement and the summer of unrest that we had, mm-hmm. Suwannee has really felt a call from God to really engage with its own past and to come to terms and to try to repair damage to the extent that they can all these years later. We have some complex characters in the history of the University of the South. People may not know that a number of Southern Episcopal bishops during the Civil War actually became Confederate generals. Big figures like Leonidas Polk, James Odie, the same one who was quoted about, you know, repelling domination, were generals in the Confederate Army. And then afterwards, the church did some healing and brought them back into the fold and back into ministry. Even one of those bishops who was a general, Bishop Charles Quintard, was the first vice chancellor, sort of the president of the University of the South. He still has a dormitory named after him that is right next to the seminary. So these are definitely things that we have to grapple with in the Suwannee community. There was another pivotal moment that was impressed upon me by the history professor, Don Armantrout, when he was still alive and was there, but that in the 1950s, the seminary had the opportunity to integrate. Province 4, which is what we call sort of the alliance of the Southern diocese around that region, had asked the University of the South to open the seminary doors to start training Black clergy. Now, the seminary was in favor of this, but the trustees took up the matter, and they had a gathering and they had a vote, and they declined to open up the doors to Black people. And as a result, all but one of the seminary faculty resigned, along with the university chaplain and the head of the college religion department. Since that time, so now Suwannee for years has been integrated, but we still have work to do to grapple with that past and to come to terms with it. I was very excited to see that recently the University of the South had an opening for a vice chancellor and hired Ruben Brigerty. And he is already doing everything he can to really engage with the past and to help people to be aware of it, to learn from it, and then to figure out ways that we can try to repair some of the damage. So currently the University of the South has a commission that is looking in detail over this whole issue, and hopefully we'll have some good recommendations for how the University of the South can move forward. Stay tuned, and we'll be back with Faithfully Memphis.
And it said, something about the 90s. Something about the 90s. It is the sweetest night day I know. I love that. Oh,
how I love the 90s.
Wave your hand if you love it.
Oh, how I love the 90s.
sweet name, yeah, yeah.
It is the sweetest name.
Sweetest name I know.
I know.
Look here. Some people say I'm crazy, but I can't explain the power that I feel, yeah, when I call your name. Said it's just like fire shining in my bones, when the Holy Ghost gets to moving. Something, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Something about the name Jesus.
Oh, oh my.
Something about the name Jesus.
Sweet name, yeah, yeah.
It's the sweetest name.
Oh, yeah.
I know.
Wave your hand if you love him.
Oh, how I love the name Jesus.
If he's been good to you, give him a two-hand wave.
Oh, how I love.
Somebody open your mouth and give him some fruit from your lips. Alone. I got some more news for you. At the name of Jesus, every knee is gonna have to bow. You don't have to wait till the fire comes. Show me what you're working with. You can clap your hands. Praise him now. Name, yeah.
It is the sweetest name.
Sweetest name I know.
I know.
Some folk that really love him, get loud up in here.
Oh, how I love the name.
Come on, let me hear you get loud up in here.
Oh, how I love
the name. Let me hear you have some church up in here.
It is the sweetest,
yeah,
name.
Inspiration. This next note is a little high. I need some inspiration.
Well, that's about all the time that we have for today. I want to thank you for tuning in, and I hope you'll join us next Thursday, same time, 8 a.m., for Faithfully Memphis on 91.7 FM radio. Take care and God bless.